Hello and welcome to the Pain Cave. My name is Jay Friedman. I am your host here in the Pain Cave, where I seem to have taken up a permanent residence. Tonight we're going to be talking to a good friend and training partner of mine, Brian Oestreich, who is here with me tonight. Say hi, Brian.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, welcome to our inaugural podcast. This is going to be a good time, I hope. We're new at this, so bear with us as we fumble our way through the beginning of a recording career. What I'm hoping to do here with this show is kind of get into some maybe underreported aspects of running, ultra running, trail running. My career, my day job is as an emergency physician, and I'm also an exercise scientist. So I'm kind of hoping that we can get into some interesting physiology discussions, medical discussions as it relates to distance running, trail running, ultra running. We'll get into physical therapy. We'll get into the mental aspect of the sport, which is kind of becoming more important, and our understanding of it every day. But mostly I just want this to be a fun time. It's going to be a hang where we can talk about stuff that's tangentially related to running and stuff that's not even really tangentially related to running. I guess I'd include beer as tangentially related, since it seems like you can't really have a conversation about trail running without having a conversation about beer. But, you know, we'll see where it takes us. So thiks for joining us on our maiden voyage here. As I mentioned, tonight we have my friend Brian. Brian is a neighbor of mine up here in upstate New York, and an excellent runner. He's a beer connoisseur. He has a fascinating athletic and professional background that we'll get into a little bit. And he's just an all-around interesting guy. So, Bri, welcome. How's it going? I haven't seen you in like 3 weeks.
Yeah, it's been too long. Hanging in there, just trying to get through the hot summer up here. Not enough running, but still recovering from the Bighorn 100, which...
Yeah, let's start there. Actually, I wasn't necessarily going to start there, but that kind of has been the story of your recent running and your summer so far. And then maybe we'll get into your background a little bit. But yeah, Brian, you were at Bighorn this year, which was fairly epic, and I think a lot of people have heard about what went on there. But yeah, take us through that a little bit, because that was Bighorn's an interesting race in that it gets it doesn't quite maybe get as much attention as it should in terms of the difficulty, in terms of just the exposure. But it really is kind of a mini Hard Rock, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I didn't really know much about the Bighorn. I had heard some good things, but yeah, basically back in December when we were all waiting for the Western States and Hard Rock lottos to unfold, it was about halfway through the Western States lotto, and I just had this instinct after the fifth year, 10th ticket or whatever it is, that I wasn't going to get in. So I just preeminently registered for Bighorn, figuring I better register for something because it wasn't my day and I'm not going to get in. So I registered for Bighorn when there was like 40 tickets yet to be drawn on Western.
And that's hilarious because I was convinced that you were getting into Hard Rock, getting into States. Picturing your summer this year was like, how are you going to get into States, Hard Rock, and UTMB and run them all? And of course, wound up with nothing.
One of these years, I feel like my instinct...
For all of us.
I'll get into Hard Rock maybe this year, but Western, I feel like you need to be in it eight years in a row to get in. So yeah, I registered for Bighorn, and it was, the more I looked at the course and learned about it and kind of read the blogs on it, it just seemed like an awesome race for me. I did the Bear last year, which was brutally, rainy, wet, and cold. They even had to do a turnaround. And so...
Yeah, you've had some epic days times out.
And it was kind of the same kind of thing, like 20K a gain and just, maybe
like a similar profile,
doesn't get quite as many of like the, what I call the super elites that I,
but you had a little bit of that this year at Bighorn, because Bob Shebest, who's been, kind of a hard luck case a little bit this spring, but has really been running well, and maybe isn't known as a huge mountain runner, but certainly has been in form. He was there. Paul Terranova, who's always very tough and very experienced at 100 miles. I think Oswaldo Lopez might have been. I mean, there were some real names that showed up this year, which was a little unusual.
Yeah, and I might be butchering his name, but Andrew Skirka is a stud. Right. And he,
from Colorado, right?
Yeah. National Geographic Adventure of the Year, just a mega through hiker.
Really?
Yeah, I think 2009, 2010, from the big PCT to Continental Divide link up.
Oh, wow.
Hiking for 8-9 months straight and just hammering every day. But yeah, it was, the race, it was good. I'm for those of you that, don't know me, I'm basically the exact opposite of Jay in that I believe in the very low mileage kind of show up under injured, underprepared. And
to be fair, you were in better shape for this than I've seen you in a while.
Yeah. But still 40, 50 miles is pretty good for me. And you're doubling that consistently. So that was the case for Bighorn, but I did do some good Catskill kind of test runs, if you will.
You had some pretty big days leading.
Yeah. And a little faster.
Right.
A little more focused and
right, maybe a little more run specific training than you've had in the past.
Yeah.
Or at least recently. But the story from Bighorn this year, much as it was at Bear, was really the weather.
Yeah, it was an interesting day because everybody warned of the heat and because it was terribly hot last year, but it's a weird race because it's usually 11 a.m. start and it was a 10 a.m. start, so everyone has to go through the night no matter where you're finishing, which I think is fair for the mid packers.
How did your body react to a later morning start?
I'm a morning person, so I love the morning.
But would you have preferred a 6 a.m. start?
Every time.
See, I'm the opposite.
The Mount Fuji race a few years ago, it's a 5 p.m. start. I had to take a nap at midnight 7 hours in.
Right. 7 hours into midnight of the first night.
Yeah,
right.
Of a 28-hour affair.
And
so
I'm the opposite.
Right.
I'll, years and years of working nights and being up in the middle, I'll give me a 5 p.m. start any day. I'll wake up at 9 in the morning, eat breakfast, and go back to bed getting ready for a 5 p.m. start. So, so that was an adjustment for you. But what was the weather like? Because
it was awesome off the start, and it was kind of a weird, it's like a 6 or 7 mile, 4,000 foot gain start. Basically, everybody kind of was packed up and nobody was making a move. I was surprised to sort of be in the posse of 10 off the front, and even kind of pushed off the front a little bit towards the top because I just was surprised everybody was as chill as they were.
Yeah, it's a fun change.
And for me, passing Paul Terranova is what am I doing?
Right.
And knowing that he's, known as one of the smartest runners out there.
Exactly.
And basically he's going to hunt you down.
That's a Cornell education. That's what that
gets
you.
Okay. Jay's from Cornell, in case you couldn't tell. So it was kind of just plugging along, taking care of yourself for the first 40 miles. And then at basically mile 38, you start this big climb. Mile 32. It's like a 14 or 15 mile climb.
Wow.
That's only has 4,000 feet of gain, but it's, people were claiming it was super wet. And so I grabbed the poles for that and geared a little bit more up, but
right.
I had a Houdini coat, a Ghost Whisperer. So both super light windstopper jackets and a buff. And I think I grabbed some medical rubber gloves just in case.
Right.
It didn't look that bad, but by the top of this pass, it was complete survival fest and had everything on and just, was using the poles. I mean, you'd basically be sliding back on every step, and it was horrible, freezing rain. And I'm more of a climber than a runner. I've been in some terrible situations, and it was close to desperate.
As bad as it gets.
And I thought I was reasonably well prepared, even though I was soaked through to the bone, and at least I had a little bit with me.
Right.
And I think I got to the top in maybe fifth or sixth place.
Right.
But, I just tend to get gapped on the uphills. I don't know if I'm kind of too relaxed or what. But I got to the top, and my friend Kyle Hess was there to pace me down. I luckily had a full-on raincoat, and I basically put this thing on with the hood. Deja vu with the bear, because I've never like run in a full raincoat besides right. in the last 200 mile races I've done.
Right.
Both of which I had like a full blown raincoat on with the hood on and everything for like 12, 14 hours, which I think says it all. So it was crazy slippery. And you know, if I have a strength, it's definitely on the downhills.
Right.
And I took like three or four diggers, and the one guy I was running with, I got some separation on him. Passed a few people at the bottom, but you couldn't even tell who was who because it was so muddy and like you couldn't, you know,
cold, wet.
You couldn't look up for a second and maybe not fall over. And right. like they were hard, like fall hard.
Right.
and but more so, I think I didn't realize that this race gets like 300 to 400 entrants. So right. I think it's close to one of the biggest in the country, you know, Leadville.
I mean, especially for a big mountain yeah. one like that.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, the conditions, I mean, you know, we have our own kind of challenges running, you know, East Coast trail running, which I know is a point of contention for a lot of folks around here, and we'll get into on a later show. But just by dint of the altitude, we don't have the kind of just mega weather changes like that sort of stuff.
Right.
At least not most of the time.
Right. And, yeah,
I mean, you can really get yourself into some problems yeah, there. I mean, this is what ultra, like mountain ultra running is about.
It is. It's big Wyoming Wild West country, and
right.
you feel it. And it's later in the race, it got really interesting. But
right, I mean, didn't somebody just like come stumbling out of the woods wearing a garbage bag or something?
Oh, I mean, so I mean, I think I later learned that everybody that was ahead of me took big breaks at the turnaround, were taking full garbage. I mean, people were running in ponchos and like these are like right. the leaders. And on the way down, I passed 200-300 runners, and some of them, I mean, it looks horrible. Like it's just like it's like, oh man, I'm just like, I can't even look at these people because it'll soften me right now, and I don't need that right now. And yeah, so it was kind of that for a long time, and I thought I was gonna be, you know, ditching the poles basically on that one climb. I ended up keeping them like the whole race,
night,
which
basically
I don't know, poles can kind of be crutches and they can kind of get you limping along. So I, for me, I have a tendency to want to use them as crutches. So it's not going to help with the running gait or anything. But this race, you would
just to stay upright.
Yeah. It, like in the flats and even some slight downs, it was so muddy and so tacky that you'd be pawing at the dirt and you couldn't get traction. So the technique was to run in the trail for 10 steps. Your feet would get globbed up, so you'd like jump into the sagebrush and run in that, where there was like rock and like whole mines, and
just to clean
the mud off of shoes. And you, I mean, there was like this.
I'm sure, the park service is thrilled.
12, 14 hours, you know, just and the hard part on that is it was sure it's hard to move in, but it's just frustrating because you set goals and you set splits and like all of that stuff just goes up.
You just got to check it out.
Yeah, it's just. You know,
but it is, it's hard, especially like you said, you're starting on the later side, you're going to be in the middle of the night, you know, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And it is hard to keep, you know, a positive mindset, which is really what so much of the sport is about.
Yeah.
So anyway, we won't belabor this race. I mean, this is it was a fairly epic day. The finishing
yeah.
rate was well under 50%.
Yeah.
And there was a fairly epic finish that you were a part of too.
Yeah.
So tell us, take us through the last 5 to 10 miles.
So the one section I have to add was coming into like mile maybe 75. And I think I was in fourth or fifth, and I was feeling super low. Like I said to my pacer, I'm like, man, like I'm done racing. I'm so over. Like I was going to finish, but I was like done racing.
Right, right.
And we come out of this aid station as we're leaving. The guy's like, yeah, there's some kind of big animal out there. And just like, he's like, it's either a wolf or a mountain lion. And it's just like, oh. And like, I was so, you know, just totally fried at the time that it like, you might as well told me that, you know, the sun is, you know, is yellow.
Green.
Like, whatever. It doesn't, it, you know, it's like, okay, cool. There's a mountain lion. Big deal. I'm going to keep going. See you later. And it was, they had to shoot 8 flares at this mountain lion to get it off the course. Like it was,
oh God.
Which is, you know, it's that kind of course. So, Yeah, I switched pacers at like mile 82, and it was a climbing friend, client who's, you know, run up Everest in solid form, super strong guy, not much of a runner at all. Like, this was actually the longest run he's ever been on.
Just an aerobic beast.
Yeah, but he knows the area. And I was like, I think in fourth place, and just, you kind of, you're basically working towards the section where you start to drop, you know, the 4,000 feet, 8 miles. And I'm like trying to run with him, but again, it's still this frustrating mud. And we get to this pass, and like, I'm actually kind of feeling like bad, because I told him I was going to get to that aid station like an hour ahead of when I did. You know, right. It was just like over races, over beers the night before the race. And so anyway, we get to the downhill. And I'm like, I'm literally just pushing because I feel bad for him for still being out there at 5 a.m.
It's just only the guilt is keeping you going.
Like, because it's like, it's one of those where your quads are just... Right. I imagine it's like UTMB where you're like, you're frail because just it's trash. So steep, like you can't do anything. And anyway, we're just moving along. And like towards the bottom of this thing, he like jumps behind the rock and is like, I'm like, what is he doing? Like just like springing around like a cat. And he's like, Brian, there's a runner right up there. And then like, I'm like, okay.
I don't know if you can whisper into the mic.
Oh.
I don't know. Maybe you can.
And then he, testing. And then there was another runner, and like I'm just like, oh god, I really don't want to race. This is mile like 95, 96.
Right. Like I'm catching people, and
so
I wish I wasn't.
I sucked down like 3 gels, like thinking like, okay, maybe I will want to race in 20 minutes. And we come out of this out of the awesome buttery single track, and we get to this dirt road, which is basically where we started. Now the end of the race, you have 4 miles on a dirt road, which is horribly boring. And so different from the rest of the day. And there's an aid station kind of recessed behind us, and the 3 leaders are like standing right there, and like I didn't mean to make a move on them, like, but I didn't need anything, so I kept going and like maybe picked it up a little bit. But before I knew it, like they're all...
Did you realize that they were in... Like,
yeah,
it was
yeah.
A threat. And so at this point, you're in front, and you're just like,
okay,
I guess we're doing this.
And they all just kind of swoop back in within a minute or two, and like it was still a long ways from the race. Like,
right,
I'm not making a move, but you know, maybe picking it up a little bit.
Right.
And then there was like maybe 2 or 3 minutes of like quietness. It's just like,
just like everyone's like, how do I talk about this?
And then I think the most experienced runner and Andy was like, yeah, Brian, you know, the other 3 of us were planning on going in together. If you want to join, that'd be cool. Which was just like the greatest thing ever for me, because I'm pretty confident I would have taken 4th, maybe 3rd. But so I said, yeah, game on. And then we all kind of like a minute later, someone's like, oh, well, how about we take a walk break?
Nice.
And so that happened like two or three times.
It was a pretty chill, nice last few miles.
10, 11 minute pace. But everybody was just trashed. It didn't feel like a race. It felt like a survival.
You were just right.
I'm sure it's the same as everybody out there. Like no matter where you finish, just,
right.
You know,
right.
Like you said, the attrition rate was 40, I think 40% of the people
finished. Something like that. It was less than 50% finisher rate. It was unbelievable.
So
even for a race of that difficulty, that's very, very low.
Yeah, awesome race. I'd definitely go back. And I kind of, you know, we all try and do, you know, Western States or Hard Rock. But
sure.
I'm looking forward to doing those. But I think these other races are probably...
Right.
You know, probably what those races were 10 years ago.
Exactly. So exactly. No, like we said, this is kind of a Hard Rock light. I think the way you guys finished gave it a little bit of good publicity this year, and hopefully it'll turn people onto it a little bit. You know, everyone obviously is looking for Hard Rock qualifiers, which I know was one of the reasons that you had targeted this one anyway. But not that it necessarily needs a bump in popularity, but I think in general it took a little bit of a bump out of this. So, I mean, that's a nice point to kind of transition to what else I wanted to talk about, which was Hard Rock and what's been happening there recently.
Brian, just get a little closer to the mic.
Okay, yeah.
Just lean forward. We'll adjust the setup next time around.
That's our engineer, Mustafa. We're in his basement right now. Mustafa's basement is the pain cave for the time being, so...
It usually is.
So this podcast.
What are we drinking?
Yeah, this podcast is sponsored by Jackie O's Bubbly Brewery out of Athens, Ohio.
Yeah, let's hit Jackie O's at the end. We'll talk about that at the end. But I'm gonna pour another delicious Jackie O's for the three of us right now. Let's chat a little bit about Hard Rock, which is a race that has become kind of the epitome, I would say, of kind of mountain ultra running, at least in this country. Within the last few years, the explosion in the popularity has gotten just unbelievable. A race that I personally have no interest in myself, although I would love to pace you, and I'm looking forward to you and our buddy Phil getting in so I can go out there and enjoy myself. But this year at Hard, or the last couple of years at Hard Rock, have really been fascinating on the men's side particularly, and obviously a lot of that owes to Killian and what he brings just to any field. But the finishes that we've had there the last 2 years, both involving him obviously in different ways, have really spurred a lot of interest among real ultra geeks. Now the reason I wanted to bring this up, and Hard Rock's been a few weeks, and I'm sure people are kind of talked out about it, but I kind of wanted to talk about it a little bit more. You have a bit of a unique perspective on this, given your background as a climber. You mentioned that you came to trail running fairly recently, within the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years. Is that right?
Yeah, 2012 I started to try it. 2013 I like decided to push a little bit.
Well, when was Lead Man? When did you do that?
It was Lead Man in 2013.
In 13. And we'll get to that too, because that's coming up as well. But before that, you were a high altitude mountaineer.
Yep. So, I started, basically was, you know, have gravitated.
Oh, that's delicious, by the way.
Yeah, it's a Berliner Weiss. It's so good.
Oh, that's really good. Okay, we'll get to that.
So, yeah, I really have kind of meandered through sports and went from...
Yeah, you were like a collegiate soccer player?
Collegiate soccer player to a mountain biker through college. Raced a lot in college and then switched to rock climbing, moved to Asia, did a lot of trekking and you know, rock climbing. So developed a lot of skills there, which translated really well when we switched into mountaineering. I was a climbing bum for a good portion of my 20s, traveled all of South America, 4 expeditions in the Himalayas. So, the last few interesting ones, a friend and I did Everest without Sherpa support up high. And then I soloed Mount Lhotse in 2008, which was super, super awesome adventure. So, my background is in climbing. And as I actually had to start working and not kind of be a climbing bum, I went to Alaska a little bit more because with the equipment. So I use our simulated altitude training tents, right, so I can basically acclimatize before I go on these climbs. And a close friend of mine, Vern Tejas, who's a legend up in Alaska, he has like more summits than anybody on Mount McKinley. He, I think 65 or so.
Oh God.
First winter summit and survived in 1989. I befriended him and we had started talking about these speed ascents on Denali, which at the time the record was just under 24 hours. And so we took a stab at that in 2009 with like track spikes on, javelin throwing track spikes and just super minimal gear, and we were really quite close. I'd say we probably would have had it if not for some technical difficulties. And so after that, I moved to New York and I couldn't possibly from Portland and I couldn't possibly, you know, train for long efforts like that, but without getting into running. And, you know, so that's really how I got into ultra running, was to try and prep for big, you know, single shots on big mountains. And so
it was basically just about the fitness for you.
It was just about long days.
Right.
And running is kind of the best way to get those long days.
Right.
But
you're a competitive guy. I mean, you've grown up playing competitive sports, so it was just natural to move into kind of the racing aspect of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think I did though until I was perfectly content being kind of, you know, mid pack and just like surviving these runs, trying to stay not injured, and so that I could go climbing. And like, but I actually, ultra running is amazing in that you don't have to be competitive to have fun. It's like I think a very rare sport where you could have just as much fun with that mindset.
Right.
And I don't think I've found that in any other sport. So
because a lot of it's just about the experience, right?
Yeah.
It's just about the journey.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what it is. I think it's the people as well. You don't get like the type A with my work, where just with a cyclist or a triathlete, they're
right,
incredibly type A, and it actually being around that makes you want to compete,
right?
Versus this is it's people are chill and
yeah. I mean, it's interesting, even as the sport gets I don't want to say more corporate, but as media gets more interested and the profile of the sport kind of continues to grow, maybe slowly, but it definitely continues to grow, but it still does kind of retain its kind of running bum roots a little bit. I mean, we're still the ugly stepchild of at least the running community, if not the endurance community.
I like that title.
Yeah, I'll take it. Especially as long as we get to drink the beer, then that's fine.
As long as Jon Snow is running around, I'm good.
That's a Game of Thrones reference,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I just started reading the books.
Oh my gosh. Keep reading.
Yeah, no, I know. It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
All right, we won't geek out too much. But that is interesting, because what we've seen in the last certainly couple of years with what Killian's been doing, but even going back a little further to some of the, like you say, the speed ascents, what we saw from Yuli Steck, rest in peace, Yuli. But Anton has gotten more into a lot of the mountaineering kind of aspects. And, this kind of dovetails a little bit with the whole FKT culture, things like Nolan's and that sort of thing. But what is it about ultra running that appeals to mountaineers, other than just the fitness aspect? I mean, like you say, a lot of it. And for some people, that's how it starts. Like our friend Mike, who is and has been a big climber. The reason he got into trail running, he said, was just so he can link up different routes in the same day. I mean, it's just about just getting from one place to another quickly. But beyond that, beyond the fitness of it, is there something about climbing or especially mountaineering that appeals to ultra runners? Is there something about ultra running that appeals to climbers? Like, what's the crossover there? Because now, not only are we seeing like climbers like yourself and like Mike who have transitioned into running for fitness and camaraderie and that sort of thing, but we're seeing it go the other way too with what Killian's been doing with the summits of my life and the stuff that Anton's been doing, and even some of the less publicized stuff that like Joe Grant and guys have been doing. Like, what is it about the two sports that kind of meld it that way?
Yeah, I think it's just the adventure. It's fun. When you're like nervous at the start of a 100-mile run, you're nervous because you're about to go do something that's ridiculous. Like, you're about to go run and you have no idea what's going to happen, but yet you're expecting you're going to be able to pull it off. No matter how many of these you've done, anything could happen out there. And I think that uncertainty is a lot of the appeal, for me, for both sports. Climbing, I think,
to a climbing, you don't want that uncertainty. I mean, well, I guess it's always there in the back of your
mind.
It is.
And with climbing, the thing I like a lot more about running, and I can't even imagine for Killian, but like climbing, especially the Himalayan stuff, it's really slow. And if you're like a good mountain biker or a good downhill skier, you're bored silly because you're it takes you 5 minutes to get to a rock that's 30 feet away.
Right.
Yeah. And so the slow motionness of it is like agonizing.
Right.
And do you actually like that? I don't know. And
that's interesting. Right. So it's everything happens in slow motion. Right. And I mean, part of it, I guess, is there's an aspect of having to maintain mental focus. Obviously, it can be life and death up there. Is it similar? I mean, I know a lot of runners will talk about almost zoning out or getting into a kind of a zen-like state when you're kind of in the flow. Do you feel that too, or is that kind of dangerous up high?
Yeah, so No, you need to still have your stuff together. And I think your systems and your rope work and your footwork, your crampon sort of technique, all of that stuff has to be robotic and automatic because there is no room for error. And that's why I think with, not to go too far off here, but a lot of climbers that are, or trekkers, I should say, that want to go do the seven summits,
right,
they have a tendency to skip those steps. Like you know, you should try and get hundreds of hours and crampons, you know, in before you go do something, because when you're up high on Everest,
right,
you know,
it's got to be automatic.
You don't want to catch your gator with, you know, or your boot with your crampon, which can easily happen. So,
and that could be the end of a summit attempt right there.
I mean, it could be the end of your life. Yeah. So, but you know, that agonizing slowness,
right,
that just totally sucks in climbing. It's, there's got to be something similar to, you know, you did the 24-hour race in Cleveland last year, which is
right,
horribly boring. Like, you're running in a loop for 24 hours. Like, it's the same sort of mental, you know.
Right. That crossover, I think, there, I mean, you touched on something. Like, the ability to just, have this kind of, I don't want to say single-minded focus necessarily, but, right, just to be at peace with the fact that, you know, all I'm doing is putting one foot in front of the other and there's nothing interesting about it right now.
Yeah.
Whether you're doing it at, you know, 9 minute pace or whether you're doing it at, you know, five meters per minute or something. I mean,
it's really sad.
But yeah, no, that was right. I guess that's part of just the mental strength that kind of serves you well in both sports, I guess. Right. Cause that there's, I mean, a lot of it's just monotony, right?
It is.
A lot of it's just drudgery for
yeah,
both sports.
Ah, oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So, I mean, and it kind of just has to be tolerated sometimes for just these moments of, I don't know, I don't even want to say joy. I mean, just relief, maybe.
But the adventure of it, you know, I've also, you know, I've done the El Gran Traverse a few times. I've done some, you know, the La Ruta race in Costa Rica. Like, they're just fun adventures. Like, I don't, you know, kind of put myself into the climbing or the running mold. Like, I'd like to go adventuring. And I think,
right,
I think that's what's cool about what Killian's doing, like, that he has, you know, the resources and the equipment's available with carbon fiber, like Skimo gear to go and keep your toes, yet like have crampons on and
right,
run up Denali in 13 hours and then ski off of it in 45 minutes.
Right.
Like, that's,
I mean, that's the advantage,
you know,
that you didn't have in track spikes trying to do it in 24 hours.
I would never be, you know, I was reasonably close on the ascent
right,
to that. But
to Killian's even, right? I mean,
yeah,
you weren't far off.
No, well, he had 11 hours. I probably would have been 13 and a half, but his, you know, we were using sleds and trying to sled headfirst through sections. And he, you know, and a 3 hour descent. I mean, it takes a guided group 2 days to get down. So
sure,
we're going for 3 hours. Killian got down in 45 minutes.
Right.
It's like, and he must've been having so much fun. It's just crazy cool. Cause it, you know, it's a huge mountain that has a ton of fun terrain. Even if you're doing it in 21 days, if you're doing the whole thing round trip in 14 hours, it's just like, it's like an amusement park. It's just awesome.
That's crazy. Let's let's talk a little bit about Hard Rock and just kind of wrap up there again, because it was a couple weeks ago. But like I mentioned earlier briefly, Killian has been involved in two very highly publicized finishes in the last 2 years. And this, I think, was his fourth straight win there. Just, you know, further just burnishing his credentials as probably the greatest ultra runner of our generation, at least mountain ultra runner of our generation, I should say. But you have a bit of a unique perspective on what happened with him in Jason Schlarb in 2016, where they both ran it in together, a similar experience to what you had at Bighorn this year. And then this year, he fell, obviously, as most people know, fell pretty early on, I want to say in the first 20 miles or so, dislocated his shoulder, which has been a kind of recurring problem for him. And, in folks who have had one or a couple of dislocations, that gets easier and easier to happen, unfortunately. So sometimes in people who have chronically dislocated or dislocated it multiple times, it'll kind of pop out at any little thing, but that doesn't make it any less painful or difficult to deal with. From the sounds of it, reduced it himself, you know, strapped some kind of makeshift sling out of his hydration pack. And I'm sure we'll be seeing the Solomon arm sling coming to a trail race near you next year. But and then went on not only to finish, but to win the race. In fact, running away from some pretty solid ultra runners in Mike
Foot.
Thank you. Sorry, I wanted to say Wolf, and I knew that wasn't right. And Joe Grant in the late stages. Can you comprehend that?
No, I don't think anyone can. You know, he's physically, you know, so much stronger than everyone. You know, I'm sure that if you were to like study, you know, from a physiological perspective, like some of the Tour de France athletes who I see as the, you know, the most
maybe just
gifted the endurance athletes.
Olympic Nordic skiers.
That's
maybe.
Right. You know, if you were to like compare Killian to them, you know, that's the only place you could find a physical specimen of that, you know, caliber.
Right.
But what, you know, and obviously Killian's, you know, everybody's known he's extremely strong mentally, but like, this is ridiculous.
I mean, the pain tolerance is just unbelievable.
You know, we all feel sorry for ourselves at times in a 50K, in a 100 mile, you know, especially when you're puking and like, you just, you know, feeling sorry for yourself. Like, yeah, he's the Chuck Norris of ultra running. He just doesn't feel fatigue or, I mean, he won the race handily, one-armed. I mean, what else needs to be said? And the vertical gain involved. It's just his training and stuff must dramatically help, because a 9,000-foot shot, you know, if anybody, you know, here on the East Coast, to get 9,000 feet in a week is pretty good. And I'm sure Killian gets it daily. And he's like, right. he's not even tired from it. So it's just the standard is, it's just so different.
So, I mean, obviously the time was not in line with some of his course record performances, which, you know, we can obviously forgive him for. Where does this performance, like, how does that stack up for you among kind of Killian accomplishments? Like, you know, Everest twice in a week with, you know, some kind of maybe convoluted speed records there. I don't want to get into that too much. But I don't know. Mont Blanc, FKTs, UTMB. I mean, is this the greatest thing he's ever done just because of just the degree of difficulty?
I certainly enjoy, like, reading about everybody's efforts and accomplishments in the sport, but I don't think I'm the one to you know, make that statement. I think
no, but more so than a lot of people in our sport, because you've stood on the top of UTMB on the top of Mont Blanc, you've stood on the top of Everest, which most of us have not.
Yeah.
I mean, you can speak to the difficulty of getting there.
Sure. You know, for Everest, you were asking about Hard Rock. For Everest, the extreme accomplishment to me is that no one has ever summited Everest without oxygen twice in one season. And, you know, it's one thing to talk about other Westerners, but, like, you know, the true accomplishments that happen every year are the Sherpas.
Oh, the Sherpas, right.
And so who can run circles around everyone? And so no one's tried that. I suppose it's different because they're trying to make a living while they're over there. But
right.
The fact that he could, you know, the reason he was able to do that is because he's strong enough and fit enough that he doesn't stay up high for long where you wither away. He can just fly up and back down because he has just, you know.
And so maybe, I mean, obviously amazing recovery powers, but maybe you don't need quite as much recovery because you're not.
That's right. You're not disintegrating up high.
Right. And disintegrating is the word for it.
But,
probably.
You know, even that, like Killian, you know, his first climb, I mean, I'm good friends with Adrian Ballinger, who got his first oxygenless ascent this year as well. And I guess Killian stopped into his camp on the way down on his first attempt. I mean, Killian was really sick on that first climb. And
right. It sounded like a rough.
He kept going. And right. So, you know, and certainly he had bad luck this year, which is what's incredible. In terms of the weather and timing, you know, it's hard. I think the hardest thing on Everest is there's probably 15 different speed records out there.
Right.
And it's like, which one do you do? And so Killian is a runner. And so he starts from base camp, but base camp on that side is 12 miles from ABC.
Right.
And so no Sherpa would ever try that. And right. So for me, the interesting stuff is an ascent that a Sherpa is interested in trying. And if your time holds up against the Sherpas, then it's like insane. All right. And so anyway, he gassed himself on the first climb and then still went after what I think is the interesting one on the north side, which is to go from ABC to the top. And he missed Christian Stengel's record by like 15 minutes. On his second attempt. So, you know, and Christian was super strong back then. So anyway, the fact that he did two climbs in one week without oxygen is crazy. In 1979, when Reinhold Messner like summited Everest without oxygen, like doctors were telling him he would die. It was the same as when doctors were telling Gordy, like, you will die if you try and run like a horse.
Doctors told Roger Bannister he'd die if he broke four minutes in the mile.
And so, like, now to see where we are.
Stupid doctors.
Yeah. Killian's running up it twice. Like, he's, you know, it's like a track and he's just jogging up and down. You know, I mean, it's mind boggling. So, the Hard Rock thing, for me, the most impressive stuff about Killian, by far the most impressive thing I've seen him do is, or heard of him doing, was skiing off of Denali after being that gassed and to have the athletic ability and like to be that good of a skier.
Right.
Like everybody knows he's like an incredible endurance athlete. But
right. But you're just saying from a technical standpoint.
Oh my God. To ski off a Denali pass, like on skinny skis.
Right.
And then like, I'm just picturing all these lines. Like, and I've skied off of a lot of it, but I've also unclipped and like put my crampons back on and had like a 30-minute transition because I didn't want to make two scary turns. And he linked them all and just did the whole thing. And so for me, I guess that's the crazy one.
All right,
like, the Hard Rock is, you know, awesome, but it seems like it's easy for him. Like, doesn't it?
I mean, kinda, right? Like, I don't know. I wanted to be, or the interview that I wanted afterwards was like with Mike, you know, at 93 miles, Mike, how are you trying to figure out, like, what can I say to Killian that will allow him to run it in like I did with Schlarb the year before?
Yeah.
Like, how does Schlarb pull that one off? You know, I mean, it does. He almost makes it seem too easy. Which, you know, you don't want to downgrade the performance. Not that it needs to be downgraded. It was unbelievable. But yeah, I mean, sometimes you just feel like it's a joke for him.
Need some excellent diplomacy skills, I suppose.
Right. Right. But, he's amazing. And I think what makes him a great ambassador for the sport too, is just that you can tell he just gets so much joy out of it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
he's having more fun than everybody.
Right. He's having more fun than all of us, and nobody begrudges him any of his success because he's humble and he's respectful and he's clearly, this is how he wants to live his life, and he's better at it than any of us.
I can't wait to see how long he lasts, Jay, because like there's so many stories out there of people at this like level.
He's been doing it for a while.
No, I mean, he's like Tom Brady. He's, you know,
he is kind of like Tom Brady.
I mean, like,
and he's still young is the thing. I mean, he kind of came onto the scene at UTMB, and I mean, he might have been 20, 21,
maybe,
I mean,
even just 19. Yeah, like young.
Right.
I mean, he's 10 years in and he's like easily dominating.
I mean, UTMB is going to be fun. If he's healthy, if his shoulder
is he
going to
be competing?
I haven't heard one way or the other for sure. I mean, it's going to be interesting either way, especially with the U.S. talent in the field this year, which is just, you know, unprecedented for us. But I mean, if you throw him into that mix with Jim and Tim and Dylan and Sage and everybody else, it's, let's not forget Schlarb, of course, who's been top three or four there before. That's going to be crazy. You had, I know on a previous run, you had said it was like Jordan's flu game.
Yeah, it is. It's like Jordan's flu game.
Right? I mean, that's, it's something else.
If you're going like ESPN top, you know, 100 sporting moments of the century, you probably should put Killian's up there.
I guess. I mean, if you're putting it in that kind of context, like, where do you rank Adam Campbell? Like 2014, he gets struck by lightning and finishes third.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Do you take winning with a dislocated shoulder, or do you take surviving a lightning strike and coming in third? I don't know.
Yeah. It's fun to think about.
All right. Well, I've taken a lot of your time. I know it's been a busy week at work, but let's just touch on a couple of things before we go home and drink more beer. you had mentioned a little bit very briefly earlier on about what you do in terms of the altitude stuff. And since this is supposedly a physiology-oriented podcast, let's talk a little bit about that. Tell everybody here in the Pain Cave what it is that you do.
So I work with Hypoxico Altitude Training, and we do simulated altitude environments. So primarily our clients will sleep in a tent and utilize that for sea level performance. So and historically that's been kind of the deal, mostly runners and cyclists, endurance athletes that are using it for sea level performance. So they'll sleep at 9,000-10,000 feet. When I got involved, I had already climbed Everest, and I had thought through it, and just like, well, if I can acclimatize and sleep at 16,000-17,000 feet at home, how quickly can I go climb this mountain? And so basically that's how I got involved. And now I'm part of the management team, and we still build upon the tent-based training and the home user systems, but we also have pretty elaborate full-on systems where we can convert entire rooms, dormitories, swimming lanes, kind of anything you can think of.
Swimming lanes, Jesus.
Yeah, so kind of buoys over an entire swimming lane, and so you can swim at altitude. So we have a few of those systems around the world, which is pretty out there. So and just really amazing. I mean, I love talking about sports and just a fan of all sports, and so we get to work with the greatest athletes in the world, and and it's just a lot of fun to kind of learn and try and help them apply this training to what they do and you know, get specific in supporting that.
Was the business, like, before you came on and you, like you said, you got involved from the climbing aspect of it. Was the business as involved in kind of some of the other, I don't want to say more traditional sports like it is now? Like, I know you have a lot of pro team clients, and you guys are kind of not, I don't want to make this a commercial for Hypoxico, obviously.
Yeah.
Go to hypoxico.com. I mean, you guys work not only with Killian and a lot of endurance athletes, but with a lot of pro sports teams, just in terms of building endurance, or teams that have to compete at altitude sometimes, for example, if you're going to Denver for a game or something like that. Was that aspect of the business there, or is that something that you guys have kind of built up recently?
It's across the board. And I mean, we've had so many weird, unique scenarios. I mean, when David Blaine broke he broke Houdini's record of holding his breath underwater.
Hopefully not holding his water.
Yeah, that'd be. Yeah. So he, we've had just weird kind of scenarios, and we've had, a ton of climbers that did push it way back when, but I think with ultra running, everybody would agree that we're way less scientific than, say, a triathlete or a cyclist. And so we really haven't, there's been kind of, we've gravitated towards more of the, sort of dirtbag sports, like you said earlier.
Right.
And that's as the dirtbag sports are getting, more scientific,
more and sophisticated,
and,
sure,
and approaching, things, more systematically, I guess. So so it's primarily and historically been like endurance based. Recently we've had, there's been a few studies that support using our equipment for repeat sprint performance. So cyclists hockey players, basketball players, 30 second intervals with the mask on, 30 seconds off. And it's shown to improve your resistance to that last interval. So you're
resistant to fatigue, basically. Yeah.
You're resistant to fatigue and ability to still push in the fourth quarter or the third period or whatever it may be. And so,
see, now that's interesting. So you're doing resisted sprint training basically with a mask. And the mask obviously is simulating altitude, just
that's
like
right.
A tent would. So, there's this whole, live high, train low, live low, train high, different. So that would be obviously on the live low, train high side. Now, in theory, the physiologic basis for simulating altitude is to boost your red blood cells, to boost your oxygen carrying capacity, and to basically you're going to have more oxygen around and your endurance is going to improve as a result of that. Now, for that, you're going to need longer repeated exposures to altitude, which is where the whole live high, train low theory comes from. But what you're saying is repeat sprint training with a mask. So these are people who are living at sea level and spending short bursts of intense activity at quote unquote altitude or simulated altitude. They're actually seeing, you're seeing a resistance to fatigue even based on that.
That's right. So it's improved lactate buffering and I mean, I think that's probably the main buzzword, right. But, you know, it's not a hematological change like the long, slow exposure is that, you know,
right.
I'm
not changing
for
the oxygen carrying capacity. You're changing basically the ability of the body to deal with the sequelae of intense activity.
That's right.
So that's on a biochemical level, and that might even be on a neuropsychological level as well.
Yeah.
Just, you know, in terms of just the response to pain or the response to discomfort. That's fascinating.
It is. And, you know, we have, we geek out on all the sports stuff, but there's really cool medical applications. Like we just had University of Alabama released a study yesterday where it's helping. Basically, you put a mask on at 21,000 feet and take it off put it on for 5 minutes, take it off. And it's helping overweight women with breast cancer in some capacity. So there's Emory University is doing stuff with spinal cord rehab patients where the exposure to the hypoxic stimulus is helping excite nerve endings.
Huh.
So it's helping people with limited mobility. So there's cardiac heart failure patients at Einstein Montefiore University who, you know, can't even walk upstairs because they're at risk of having a heart attack. And so, but they need some stimulus to strengthen the heart. And so they'll sit in a lazy boy in one of our altitude tents, but at 9,000 feet. And so it's helping them strengthen their heart, lower their heart rate a little bit. And so it's a limited dosage, but it's enough to sort of to help in a very controlled way.
That's amazing.
So all kinds of different cool directions.
Wow. Wow. Now, what, I mean, you don't have to give me exact numbers, but what proportion of your clients are more interested in the living high, the tent, you mm-hmm. know, room conversion type things, and what proportion are more looking at the masks for targeted like high altitude training?
Yeah, and just to be clear, the masks are connected to a generator. They're not the rebreather masks.
Right, right.
Marketed.
We're not talking about like those like faux ski masks that are supposed to limit the. I mean, which have, let's be clear, been shown not to do anything in terms of adapting the body to altitude. Although we've talked about this a little bit previously. It may strengthen the diaphragm, maybe just making it harder to breathe. Maybe your respiratory muscles get a little bit of a boost, but maybe, right.
That's right.
Unproven and certainly have, you know, no proven benefit in terms of, you know, simulating altitude itself. But right, these masks are hooked up to a generator. You're actually, you can simulate whatever kind of altitude you want limiting the amount of oxygen that they can breathe.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. The you know, so it's not just mask based either. We have like our office, we have an altitude room, so the whole
right.
room is sealed off, so we can exercise in there, which is great. You know, it's hard to pinpoint that because the generator is a tent and it can be paired with a mask, so we don't always know what our clients are doing. But certainly in kind of the mainstream sports,
mm-hmm.
We're seeing more of the mask-based equipment. And, you know, a big challenge we've always had and probably always will is that the significant other doesn't want to sleep in the tent. And
right.
So it's also just lifestyle is what it is. But, you know, you can get, I mean, as with, you know, any training program, it's like, you know, you have to figure out what your needs are and sort out a game plan. So, you know, some people have greater needs for, you know, aerobic capacity.
Right.
Whereas, you know, some cyclists need more matches to burn and that mask-based interval training is going to help with that. So,
right. That's interesting because we won't belabor the altitude stuff, but just that's interesting that you mentioned that. Like you would think normally we think of cycling as obviously a long endurance type thing and you know, you need that increased oxygen capacity, but at a high level, what a lot of cycling races are is a series of sprints, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's a lot of really short, high intensity efforts interspersed with, you know, long periods of riding, but which are generally aerobic. And, you know, if you're on the Peloton and drafting, you're probably not exerting all that much, and your oxygen requirements are probably not that high. And a lot of times at that level, it does kind of become an anaerobic sport, much like basketball or hockey or something like
that. So, you know, it's hard to pinpoint. We try, but we've certainly shifted more towards climbing and acclimatization than we, I think, did in the past. But, you know, the markets have also grown. And so that's you know, hard to say. But, you know, right now there's in ultra running, there's so many high altitude races that there's a ton of overlap. You can, you know, I typically, you know, try and stage before a race 3 months in it, and I'll just be acting like I'm an endurance athlete sleeping at 9,000 feet until I get close to the race. Then I'll start to add, you know, kind of higher sleep elevations and some of these harder workouts to try and mimic what Hope Pass is going to be like at Leadville, or, you know, I mean, Hard Rock. It's, we've had a lot of clients. I mean, cause Hard Rock is just insane to try and, you know, push at 14,000 feet and like,
especially coming from sea level, like we are, I mean, it's a huge disadvantage unless you can really prep yourself for it.
Even if you live out there, it's so hard. It's so hard. You're so slow.
All right. I did want to talk about Leadville, but you know, we'll just, you're around, we'll have you back on another time. Cause I, you know, Leadville is coming up, and I know you've done the Lead Man, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that and, the cycling and everything else, but maybe after Leadville, which is in a couple of weeks, we can talk about that. Last thing we got to cover is Beer. It is a running podcast. It is an ultra running podcast. So Beer is obviously of near primacy in terms of importance. And you have a connection that a lot of us don't have.
Yeah, my my brother is founded Jackie O's Brewery in Athens, Ohio, which is Ohio University's town, like 10, 12 years ago. And so he's doing awesome in the state of Ohio. And I've managed to get quite a bit of his beer here in New York. So we're drinking his Berliner Weiss. He's got an awesome sour room and his IPA as well this evening.
Yeah. So we don't want to make this a commercial for Hypoxico, but we will definitely make this podcast a commercial for Jackie O's as long as he keeps supplying us with beer.
There we go.
We had a really... just a really good kind of standard IPA. I mean, there's not a lot of, you know, magic to it necessarily. I don't want to say it's not delicious. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward IPA.
Yeah.
It's just really, really good. And it's not overly hoppy, which is where a lot of people, especially brewers just first starting out, kind of run into trouble. I mean, obviously he's been doing this for a long time, but the Berliner Weiss was really, really good. I mean, I'm into sours, and it's just got that nice sour
so
kick.
So good. He's got a Gosa as well. I just, it's so good, especially on a nice summer day.
Is the Gosa strong enough? Do you get enough? Like,
no, it's kind of like a, you know, it's pretty light. I mean, it's like 4.5%.
So yeah. That's a back porch kind of summer kind of beer, right?
Yeah.
You know,
it's so good.
Maybe a little bit of a tang to it, but you know, it's just not anything that's going to knock you over. And he's done a lot of stuff with, I know I've had before aged in whiskey barrels and different things where you get a real rye flavor and stuff like that.
Yeah, so he's close to, he's only like an hour from the Kentucky border. So he has like a deal with people that make furniture out of whiskey barrels. They'll drive them up and drop off, you know, I think he gets like 50 of them like a month or so. Whiskey,
this,
bourbon
this
barrel.
Illegal.
Bourbon barrel
Mustafa,
whiskey
we'll have to cut,
stuff.
We'll have to cut all this.
It's, and
otherwise,
just really, really funky stuff. That's
the,
you know,
they're going to be raining. Jackie,
you can't. It's the exact opposite of the Gosa. You can't drink. You know, they taste incredible, and you know, but it's like you can't really drink too many of them because they're so big, especially if you're an ultra runner, because you're probably not hydrated enough.
Just like chronically decreased blood volume. All right. If you're in the Athens, Ohio area or anywhere in Ohio, they do distribute elsewhere in Ohio. So everyone in Cleveland, go out and pick up some Jackie O's send us more beer, guys. Anyway, I think that's probably about it. I've definitely taken up enough of your time. I know you're heading out to Vietnam this weekend for a big installation for work. And then you said you're out to California and unfortunately going to miss the Leadville mountain bike race, which is a bummer.
Yeah.
But next year we're doing two weeks in Leadville, right?
I think that's the plan.
Okay.
See how those lottos go.
No, no, no. You're just getting me in.
Yeah, I'm going to get... Yeah, I'm going to bike. Oh, you're going to run.
Yes, yes. No, we'll see how the other lottos go.
That's right. I mean, Hard Rock, we'll see how tired my legs are for that.
Not that Leadville is anyone's backup plan, but Leadville is kind of the backup plan.
No, that's your primary race. You've been talking about it for
I mean, unless the state's gods smile upon me, which I'm not... not particularly hopeful of. But Carl, if you're listening, I wouldn't mind, you know, you could pull my name out of that hat. That'd be very useful. Anyway, thank you for joining us on the inaugural episode of the Pain Cave. We're very psyched to have had you. I hope we didn't bore you too much. Thanks to Brian Ostreich, my companion for this maiden voyage. Thanks to Mustafa for allowing us to kick his family out of the basement and use his very, very expensive looking equipment, which hopefully we've done justice to. Thank you guys for joining us, and we'll see you next time in the Pain Cave.
Broken down and beaten up, the years have been long and tough, but I'm not dead. Happy now just to spend some time with friends and have a roof above my head. I'm not jaded, just been faded like a good old pair of jeans. Rusted like a proud old car that's drove a little too far and seen too much rain. But long ago as a child I look at that, the night sky in wild wonder man. Then ride the bus, feel upset to think of all the years I'd have to go through there. I was still young, I was still young, and I was still